Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
I'd first like to talk about my recent experience. I was on vacation, and so I had a very, very long flight back, and that had to do with some difficulties with the airplane and, well, just, you know how it goes in travel, it sort of snowballs. But it got me thinking about the fact that I should probably give you my favorite travel tips for staying healthy, because, wow, there's a lot involved, and probably the most dangerous thing about air travel is something you may not even have thought of, and that's the problem of thromboembolic disease. So a thrombus is a blood clot, and an embolus is a blood clot or something else that's traveling through the blood vessels. Very, very not good. These blood vessels can go to your brain. They can also go to your lungs. Typically, they go to the lungs, which can be lethal. When they go to your brain, it's because you have a little hole in your heart. And it turns out that maybe 5% of people actually do have a little flow across from the right heart to the left heart. This is something that we all have as infant, well, before we're born, as embryos. And at the time that we're born, that little hole, that little trap door slams shut, but in some people it never quite locks, and they can end up later in life with a stroke from a blood clot in their leg. Now, venous thromboembolism is a huge cause of death, about 50,000 deaths in the United States alone. And people who are at high risk for this, well, it might be you. Anyone with a history of a prior DVT, anyone with any kind of coagulation disorder, thick blood, obesity, if you have limited joint mobility, like bad lower extremity arthritis, if you have large varicose veins, if you have any cardiovascular disease, or if you've had cancer within the last 2 years. And you're probably thinking, well, I don't have any of those things, I don't need to worry. Well, how about if you're a very fit, high-performance athlete, so fit, in fact, that you have a heart rate in the 50s? People who are young, high-performance athletes, even Olympians, actually have a statistically higher risk of DVT, particularly when they fly, because they tend to have such a slow heart rate. When they're not moving, they get more venous pooling. Another group that you wouldn't necessarily think about are people with chronic fatigue syndrome. That's sometimes called chronic inflammatory response syndrome, and it's called that for a reason, because chronic inflammation from any source, and that could include also diabetes, tends to make the blood stickier. Even people who just have a big belly will have stickier blood than people who don't have a big belly. So I can tell you, as I was looking around the waiting room at that airport, I'd say a lot of the people there were at one form or another some increased risk for thromboembolic disease. Now, I used to tell people to take an aspirin before they got in an airplane, and I still sometimes give that advice. But recently I read about a new substance and some really interesting research supporting it, and this substance is called pycnogenol. It comes from pine bark, and it's typically sold as an anti-inflammatory. But it has some other really interesting properties. One of the good things about it is that it does not increase bleeding time. So the problem with using aspirin for your flight is that it might cause a GI bleed. It might, if you were in an accident, within a day or two of taking that aspirin, you would bleed more. And so there's a little bit of risk on the risk-benefit curve that doesn't occur with pycnogenol. There were a couple of studies done back in the early 2000s that I found pretty impressive on this. In one of them, pycnogenol was taken at about, let's see, about 100 milligrams, so 200 milligrams 2 hours before the flight, and then another 200 milligrams 6 hours after the flight. And what they were looking at and there have been multiple studies, and they all found the same thing. But essentially, there's substantially less edema or swelling of the legs, a problem that I suffer from on flights, and something that my ears really pricked up, or my eyebrows really pricked up, I should say, when I read this. But also, the risk of phlebitis in several studies, which were controlled case-control studies with a placebo group, I'll tell you about one in a minute, also showed a substantial protective effect that was statistically significant to the 0.02 level, which is pretty darn good. So here's what they did in this one study. These were high-risk people who had a history of DVT, and they were put on a plane from, they were going from New York to London. So half of them received the doses I've talked about, 200 milligrams 2 hours before, the pycnogenol was combined with a compound from fermented soy called natokinase. And, you know, you can find these things in your local health food store, about the same dose, 100 milligrams. The pycnogenol actually has been shown to make blood vessels less permeable. So it increases the strength of the capillary wall. So you get less leakage, therefore less swelling. And this works well in people with venous insufficiency. By the way, folks, if we're heading into summer, if you're starting to get leg swelling in the hot weather, you might want to try this stuff. And please give me a call next week for Saturday of the month at 3 p.m. Just to let me know whether or not you think it's helping with your leg swelling as we move into summer. We also know that the natokinase increases fibrinolytic activity. In other words, it helps your blood break down clots if they're starting to form. And in this 2003 study published in Angiology, the researchers showed that the number of people getting DVTs in the control group was 5, with 5 deep ones and 2 superficial, and no events whatsoever in the control group. Now, that's good enough to get the FDA to pass on your study in terms of statistics, but you'd need larger numbers, and of course, that gets expensive. So I'm not going to hold my breath that I'm going to see a definitive FDA approval on this, although I have a story later on in the hour talking about, you know, the ups and downs of FDA approval and whether or not it's all that good. So maybe we'll segue to that. But before I do that, I want to give out the phone numbers. The phone numbers are 479-1080. So please get on your phone. If you have a question, I'd love to hear from you. Now, what other things do I suggest for flying? And my next one, and it makes you look gross, and the people in the seat next to you will give you a sideways look. Just deal. But nasal saline. So typically what I will do when I get on an airplane, the first thing I'll do is I'll take out one of those germicidal wipes, and I'll wipe down the seatbelt, which I'm going to be touching, the armrests, which I'm also going to be touching, the handle for bringing down the tray table, and the tray table, pretty much in that order. Sometimes I might use 2 wipes. Now, what I've just done is I've cleaned everybody else's germs, or at least reduced the quantity of them, on the things that I'm going to be touching, and then forgetting that I touched and scratching my nose or eating a peanut. Take that back. No more peanuts on airplane travel. But you get the point. The next thing I do is get out a Kleenex and my trusty nasal saline. And I give myself a good squirt of nasal saline in each nostril, and then I blow my nose. I'm going to repeat that every couple of hours because as you fly, the mucus in your nose dries out. Now, that mucus is actually quicksand for bacteria and viruses, and it keeps the bacteria and viruses, particularly the viruses, from getting to the surface of the epithelial cell, where they are actually adapted to grab onto the cell, attach themselves, and inject their genetic material and infect that cell. So if I can keep the viruses struggling to, because they don't swim, on a layer of mucus, I can wash them out, swallow them, and destroy them in an acid bath in my stomach, which is what you're supposed to be doing if everything's all systems go. Air travel interferes with that. And yes, they use filters on the air circulate, but you're going to high altitude, you're affecting the oxygenation of your tissues. We actually see, and this was another thing that pycnogenol supposedly prevented, we see brain swelling on airplanes. And if you do a CT scan on people who have been on an airplane and gotten off, you'll find that there is edema of your brain. And the longer you're on the flight, the more edema. This may account for some of the symptoms of jet lag. We're not really entirely sure about the causal loop there. We've always thought it was more of a circadian rhythm thing. But hey, I certainly feel kind of foggy and loggy when I'm up there at altitude. Maybe my brain is swelling. There aren't too many in-flight CT scanners, so I guess we'll just have to go by this study. But nevertheless, my point here is you want to do something preventative against deep vein thrombosis. If you don't want to take a substance, at least wear those airplane socks and get up and move every couple of hours. That can be difficult. Another thing, stay hydrated. A lot of people don't want to have to stand in line at the bathroom, or they're worried about having an incontinence event, so they deliberately dehydrate themselves. That's just about the worst possible thing you can do when you're flying, because that air is dry and it's sucking moisture out of your bloodstream anyway. You need to keep peeing, otherwise you're getting dehydrated. I think we'll move to that Dexcom, the FDA thing I wanted to talk about, just because it segues nicely with my comments earlier on FDA approval. So the good news for diabetics in particular is that the FDA just approved a continuous glucose monitoring system that integrates into your insulin dosing systems. So this is going to basically be the first robo pancreas for type 1 diabetics, and it will allow them to essentially, without having to do anything, this device can talk to the automatic injector and insulin pumps and deliver or order a dose of insulin. It's also supposed to predict low blood sugars, and this is really awesome technology. Here's where I disagree with what the FDA is doing. This is the first device that was able to use the so-called 510 clearance pathway. And this is a loophole that was put in place recently that allows for devices that are quote-unquote substantially similar to other devices to get a fast-track pathway for approval rather than having to start all over and go through a level 3 approval. Well, the problem with that in this device is that while there are glucose monitors and already existing that can be plugged into your skin so you don't have to prick your finger, and there are automatic insulin dosing systems, the so-called insulin pumps, available, the software that connects the glucose monitor to the insulin pump, there's no substantially similar thing. But you see, the device regulations are written for devices, and the drivers for the devices are kind of off there in oblivion because the FDA isn't really thinking about software error. So they let this thing go through based on a study of 324 adults and children for 10 days. And nobody had low blood sugar, no serious complications, so yep, you can roll with this. Don't be the first on your block, folks, to try new devices anymore. If you absolutely positively need the device and there is nothing like it that already exists and has a track record, okay. But just because this is the newest, coolest, fastest, least troublesome, yeah, that's until the other shoe drops. A 10-day study? What about when these kids get nausea and vomiting and don't eat for a couple of days? What about when someone does an all-nighter and has higher cortisol levels because of stress? What about in a situation of sepsis? Is this device still going to have the ability to predictively make the right decision? Well, maybe, but then again, maybe not. And I think that things like this, these little robot substitutes for internal organs, we really have to have a high barrier for that, a high level, before we release it. That's my opinion. One last thing before we go to emails. The Trump administration announced a new division back in January. I missed the first memo This is called the, this is in the Health and Human Services Department, and its purpose is to, quote, protect health care providers who have religious or moral objections to performing medical services such as abortion. Okay, fine. This office is called the Conscious and Religious Freedom Division, and it's going to focus on outreach, policymaking, and vigorously enforcing existing federal laws that protect conscious and religious freedom rights. The American College of Physicians is a little bit worried. They cautioned that this division must not lead to discrimination against any category or class of patients as guided by the medical profession's ethical obligations. By the way, those ethical obligations state that you cannot deny appropriate care based on gender, gender identity, sexual orientation, race, ethnicity, or personal characteristics. In other words, this is not a wedding cake. This is somebody's life. Physicians have a professional obligation not to discriminate against any class of patients. There is in these American College of Physician guidelines a statement that those that have a conscientious objection to providing a specific medical service to a patient may do so, but not in an emergency situation. Now, one group that is really appalled by this new division is the HIV Medical Association. They are very concerned that this will shield providers and result in delayed or maybe no care for vulnerable individuals, such as people with HIV, members of minority groups, or gender-different people who are, you may in fact be marginalized and have to use a federal clinic or a clinic where there's only one doctor who decides that they have a moral obligation to caring for this person. It suddenly got a whole lot easier. Meanwhile, they tie it up in court for a few years and argue it. Somebody or somebodies may actually die from this. So, yeah, good move there. Looks like we've got a caller. We've got Marilyn. Marilyn, are you there?
I am. Thank you for your program. This is quite fascinating and informative. I wanted to share some information you may be familiar with. You were talking about blood cell abnormalities and being sticky. I've been reading about this article called Carrying a Cell Phone in a Backpack Leads to Blood Abnormalities. It's from electromagnetichealth.org from July 3rd of 2016. And there are pictures here of before and after exposure to this microwave radiation from wireless technology. And the pictures, which I'm sure you've seen, shows, is it called Rouleau formation?
Mm-hmm. Rouleau formation, exactly.
Oh, my God. Very disturbing, related to microcirculation being cut off and strokes and heart attacks. And I've learned recently that the airlines have Wi-Fi, and that's a problem in terms of this radiation exposure. And another source of this is a book that just came out last year, Olga Sheehan, S-H-E-E-A-N. It's titled EMF Off, A Call to Consciousness in Our Misguided Microwave World. And she has a section here on airlines, and she herself is very electrosensitive. And it's chapter 24,
Marilyn, that's a little too much information.
Yeah,
go ahead and get to your question. I think you want to make sure we all know about this, and I'd like to comment.
Yeah, and so airlines Wi-Fi on a wing and a prayer, she titles it, I'd like to see you in the next program to follow up on this. She cites airline pilot experience with microwave radiation on flights, the increase in heart attacks and strokes they've seen on flights since they instituted the Wi-Fi.
Well, I'll take Marilyn, I'm going to stop you there and say that the devil in something like this, when it's coming off of a .org, then what you have to do, and this is what I do, I'll look and see if they've got a reference. Like, for example, that statement that there are increased heart attacks, that's something that should be published in a peer-reviewed journal. There should be a link to it. If there's no link to it, then I'll try to find whether or not there is, in fact, such an article. And I will tell you that a lot of times when I track down the link, it turns out to be a link to another .org or another .net and not to anything that actually passed any scrutiny. So as we know, there's a lot of very, very strongly worded declarative statements on the internet which may not have anything to back them up. And that also goes for health stuff, so you really have to investigate. That being said, I have read a number of books on the subject of EMF radiation, and I do believe that we are engaged in a colossal scientific experiment on ourselves, that the only thing that comes anywhere close to it was when the Romans lined their aqueducts with lead because it was so good at plugging leaks, and then ended up with lead poisoning of, you know, a large percentage of their population. We are effectively potentially doing something just as damaging. And I want to put out the word, do you have grandchildren?
No, my daughter, I have a 50-year-old daughter. They decided not to have children,
but I'm very worried
about children.
If you see children, yes, children don't even have a bony protection against the microwave. So when I see a child playing with a device, particularly if they're under the age of 5, I will very politely go up to the parents and I will say, you know, please put that in airplane mode, because then your child's brain is not being irradiated, and most of the games that a 3-year-old is playing can be contained on the device. And I get that it's the modern version of the pacifier, but you can put it in airplane mode and make it a heck of a lot safer. So I want that going out to everybody here. Let's all become crusaders until we have the data. You know, we're already messing with our kids enough with these devices. Let's at least...
True, but the data is also there going back decades.
There is data. There absolutely is. And there is experimental data. The problem is that there's probably a lot of variation in terms of individual response. There's this thing called epigenetics, which means that there may be and probably is a fair amount of adaptation that we contain within our bodies to allow us to handle more microwaves. So there's probably some stuff going on under our radar that hasn't been fully studied. And the real question is whether this is a public health issue, and if so, how big, not if EMF affects cells. I think that particular issue is absolutely true. But before we go and try to put this genie back in the bottle, because this genie is thoroughly out of the bottle, it would be a major social wrench. We would need
out of control.
Let's just say that we're very far down on this road, so it's not going to change without massive amounts of data in the short term. I do think that it's prudent to put your phone in airplane mode, but I know that people aren't going to do that because people are so hooked into being interconnected. So to the extent that you don't wear it on your chest, that you take it out of your pocket, because we know it affects sperm, as far as the backpack and the rouleau formation, I'd have to look at that study because there's a whole bunch of microscopic bad science. Let's just put it that way. Really bad science.
If you could say a mailing address. I do not have a cell phone or a computer or Wi-Fi, any of that.
Sure.
I'd like
if you go, my office is 930 Mission Street, Suite 5, 930
Mission. I'm writing it down.
Number 5. 95060.
Thank you for the call,
Marilyn, and I really appreciate your bringing up the topic.
And I do what you do. I go up to people holding their babies and share info with them like you do.
Excellent.
Thank you so much.
Bye for now. All right, we're going to go now to Rory. And hold on, Rory. We'll get you on there. Hello, Rory. I think I got you.
For taking my call. And was that the the famous Marilyn Garrett?
I'm not sure. Could be.
Okay. I've had my differences with her in the past, but it's the Wi-Fi thing is interesting, and she brings it to the forefront. On a scale of 0 to 10, where do you put it on a, you know, like the 2G? We're not even at 5G, but that's a whole different scale, probably. Where do you put it on the 0 to 10? 10's an emergency.
Oh, well, I don't think it's an emergency for everybody. I have people in my practice who are clearly radio sensitive. Why? Maybe they have thin mitochondrial walls, or they have heavy metal poisoning, or something in their physiology or their genetics set them up for that. You know, we know that there are people who are in Russia, you know, near Chernobyl, there are all these animals that should be dead. They're healthy populations, and what's happened is that the ones that could survive there were the ones that had genes that gave them resistance to radiation.
And, interesting.
And so we create selective pressure, and we get a shift in the population. And so we may be seeing, I mean, who knows what sort of selective pressures this creates, and some of them will lead to beneficial adaptation, and some of them will be very toxic.
Yeah.
Where I am is, I know that children are very vulnerable. Brains are still developing. I don't think a child should be anywhere near. I mean, when I say anywhere near, 4 feet away. Okay.
From a Wi-Fi relay.
Away from a Wi-Fi. 4 feet away from a device that's broadcasting.
Gotcha.
4 feet is basically going to be 2 to the 4th power less.
Yes.
So it's, you know, it's 1/16 of what you've got when you hold it up to your ear. And
right.
If we're arguing about the effect of holding it up to your ear, then when you take that down to 1/16, I'm feeling pretty good about the risk.
Yeah. And, you know, and all of us, I mean, I use a headset now pretty faithfully. I rarely put the phone to my head, but for years, put the phone to my noggin.
Yeah.
So
Rory,
Did you have another question? Yeah, on the ethic issue, you mentioned a new sub-bureaucracy that's going to deal with medical providers or caregivers.
Matters of conscience.
Opt out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think most of that is pointed directly at people that don't want to participate in abortion. And I know you brought up the HIV issue, and you said somebody might die. I mean, who's making a case for not dealing with somebody with HIV?
Well, the HIV people are worried about it, and they're being paranoid, but I have a feeling they've been subjected to a fair amount of discrimination over the years. So
maybe that was true in the 80s when the thing first started happening, but I don't think that's the case now, and I would say that probably the reason for this legislation or this policy shift is more likely people that don't want to have to deal with an abortion.
Yeah, but who's getting forced to deal with an abortion? I mean, abortion's become so seriously marginalized in so many places.
I don't know.
If you're a woman in Texas, I mean, you buy yourself a bus ticket. You know, you're going to have to travel to get an abortion. So I don't really feel like doctors are being shanghaied and made to do abortions. I'll give you one though. Here's one that worries me a little bit, and that's the end of life. So right now in California, for example, we have something called the End of Life Option Act, right?
Yes.
And what that does is, just briefly, you need two doctors. One's the attending, the prescribing doctor. One's a consulting doctor. They both have to agree that the person is, you know, with it mentally and is not being forced to do anything. Then the person has to make two requests 15 days apart. They have to have 6 months. They have to be certified as having 6 months or less to live, and they have to be able to self-administer. So, as you can see, there's the self-administer thing. I think as a physician, that's critical for me, because it's like, okay, I can give you something that's a black pill, but you have to take it. And at that point, I'm not killing you. And, you know, my ethics are clean on that.
Right.
I'm not looking forward to participating in that.
But you wouldn't be forced to.
No, I wouldn't be forced to. And I'm not worried about being forced to. And so I pretty much think that what this will do is, you know, take the wedding cake case, I think, that went to the Supreme Court, is for me the classic example of why this sort of decision making becomes a political grandstanding maneuver, and really, you know, so I think it's a big waste of money, and I think it's political grandstanding for the most part, and I don't think anybody was being forced to go against their conscience in the first place. And it's like, okay, if you don't want to do abortions, maybe you should not take a job at Planned Parenthood, you know?
Well, of course. I don't think anybody that's got an issue with an abortion is working at Planned Parenthood.
I hope not. That would be a big surprise. But that's, go ahead.
One other quick question. I know that you're trying to do the least invasive procedures and you key on nutrition from an MD perspective. Mm-hmm. I heard the little Mayo Clinic radio spot the other day, and they were talking about new surgical techniques going through the belly button to do surgery on children to remove their gallbladders because they have gallstones. And I was just curious if you would care to comment on that, and I'll take my answer on the air.
Okay, Rory, thanks.
All right, thank you. Bye. Bye.
Well, the first thing I want to say is the fact that we're needing to do surgery on children for gallstones is pretty weird. It's also weird that we have type 2 diabetics in grade schools now, which was, they never even existed in the 80s when I was doing my training. There were no type 2 diabetics in childhood. It didn't exist. So something is seriously wrong with our food or with our pollution or with something, because we've got what we call in medicine a phenotype. The genetics haven't changed, but the manifestation of the genetics has changed. And when that happens, it's environmental input of some kind or other. You don't shift phenotype without shifting environment. And I don't think, I'm not sure what it is, but it scares the heck out of me. Now, that being said, doing non-invasive surgery laparoscopically has a long history, and it easily 30 years at this point, and people are pretty good at it. With the new surgery robots, which allow you to basically, they're Waldos, so you move your hand, let's say you move your finger 2 inches, but you've dialed it down, so when you move your finger 2 inches, the movement inside the belly of the person is 2 millimeters. And so with good visualization and practice, that allows you to stitch up really tiny things. And there is, in fact, even microsurgery on fetuses in pregnant women. So you do embryo surgery, essentially, with a very similar technique, and manage not to lose the pregnancy the great majority of the time. So we're definitely ready for prime time on this, and that one doesn't particularly worry me, but taking my bias, which is, you know, what's going on here? With our people, what's going on with, go watch a movie in the 1940s and look at the people in the background, and then, you know, go to the mall. Something has really seriously shifted, and it can't be good. We need to understand it and try to reverse it to the extent that that's possible. All right, and we're going to go now to Roseanne. And hello, Roseanne. You should be on the air.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
I'm calling for a friend of mine, and I had her write to me what she wanted me to ask you, so I'm going to read her words.
Okay.
My procedure is called a radiofrequency neurotomy, a minimally invasive procedure that disables specific spinal nerve branches from transmitting pain signals. This will be done for the sacroiliac joint. So I told you think a lot outside the box at times. And what is your opinion of it? And do you think she'll basically have a good outcome?
Sure. I'd be happy to address that. So first of all, radiofrequency surgery is kind of a fascinating thing. It's a very, very rapid radio wave. We're talking something on the level of 40,000 beats per second. And when you use it, and like microwaves, you know, this is all electromagnetic spectrum radiation. So like microwaves heat things up. If you turn up a radio wave, if it's powerful enough, or fast enough, it'll also heat things up. And it turns out you can tune the radio wave to either be a heater or to be a scalpel. And so a lot of shoulder surgeries, for example, are now being done with radio frequency surgery. So where the belly surgeries are done laparoscopically through the belly button with little tiny scissors and little tiny grippers, this is actually just a probe that will cut or burn depending upon whether you hit a blood vessel or whether you're going through, say, cartilage or something. In the case of neuroablations, you're going into the area where the nerve is coming out of the spinal cord, and the nerves split quite early, and the ones that go to the back, like the sacroiliac and the dorsal part of the body, branch out, and you can get in there with a needle and essentially fry it, heat it up and fry it. And when you do that, it provides, if the pain is in fact coming from that nerve, and that's a big F, usually like to do an injection of a local anesthetic into that area first and get a good result so that you know that the pain is not a referred pain. But assuming that all the appropriate due diligence stuff has been done, then frying that nerve will buy you a substantial amount of pain relief in properly selected cases. The thing that they don't always tell you at the front door on this is that it's a temporary benefit in a lot of people. It's not permanent. And after a year or two, the nerve may actually manage to recover. The body's pretty amazing about this. It's like when you don't want something to recover, it does. So it may be a long-term but still temporary benefit. Normally, if someone were to ask me, I'd say you want to do electroacupuncture on the area. I will try to basically retrain the nerve. There's plenty of data that when you do electroacupuncture, you can increase the endorphins and particularly the enkephalins. That's what's floating around in the spinal column. So 10 days after radio frequency work, after radio acupuncture, which is electrical, not radio, I misspoke. So let me start again. 10 days after electroacupuncture, if you do a spinal tap, you have tripled or quadrupled the amount of messenger RNA for enkephalin in the spinal column. So you're turning down the pain response through a physiological mechanism. This is not entirely just chi. You're actually changing what the DNA is doing. I find some of these studies really fascinating and do a lot of that in my medical practice. But not everyone can wait, and it is the longer you've had pain, the more anxious you are to get some relief. And if they're talking radio frequency ablation on your friend, she's probably been through a lot of other things and is running out of options. So not knowing her case, those would be my comments.
Okay, well, I think she'll find about the acupuncture very, very interesting. So I take this for her because I would never remember how to repeat everything you just said. Mm-hmm. Can I ask you one quick question for me? Do you have time?
Absolutely, but let me thank you also because you're calling from New Jersey, and so I always want to give a shout out. Go ahead. What was your question?
Okay, I do vitamins and such and herbs, and I'm just hearing a lot more now about trace minerals that our body also needs them. What's your opinion of the minerals?
Well, it kind of depends on your diet and where what you eat grows, but there can definitely be trace mineral deficiencies. Some of us need more manganese because they have a superoxide dismutase type 2 mutation. That's a fairly common mutation that makes it harder for your body to manage antioxidants or rather to use antioxidants. So you're more subject to oxidative stress. It's toxic to your mitochondria. Not a good thing to have. So if you give extra manganese, that enzyme works better. Some people need more chromium or molybdenum. And so I take a trace mineral supplement that has what are considered to be, at least empirically effective doses for the average. I may be underdosing myself with the manganese because I do have that SOD2 mutation. But yeah, I think minerals it's like an insurance policy that you take out because you don't want to have to pay to fix the the car. You know, it's like, okay, you're required legally to have a certain level of liability insurance, but if you've got a new car and you know that it's going to cost you a bundle if you get into a fender bender, you might buy the extra insurance. You still don't want to get into a fender bender, but, you know, it's worth it to do the insurance. I kind of view mineral supplementations like that. Also, many medications deplete our bodies of minerals, and in getting rid of the medication, we actually burn up things that our body needs. So it depends. If a person's on a whole bunch of medications, particularly diuretics or water pills, I really want them on a multivitamin with a mineral supplement thrown in there. And most mineral supplements will cover the ones I've mentioned, the selenium, the chromium, the manganese, molybdenum, etc.
Does your will a doctor suggest those tests for you, or can I go on to a lab by myself, or do I have to have a doctor say to do it?
What, for testing for mineral sufficiency?
Yes.
Okay. That's a good question. No, I think you can probably search, let's see, what would you search? Search urine organic acids and see if anybody will run those for you. I typically use a lab called Genova, and they do require a doctor's prescription. There are labs like Walk-In Labs that send a voucher to a local laboratory and then run the test, and you can find those online. So I don't actually know the answer, since I usually use a lab. I'm a doctor, I got the prescription signature. But, you know, if you just go to Genova, I think it's gdx.com, but Genova Laboratories, and search around on there, you can find the test, and maybe your doctor would be willing to just, you know, they set up a free account, the test kit gets mailed to them, they order it. A lot of times you can get this stuff covered if you're Medicare age because of, you know, various health problems that you might have. You might be able to even get the test covered, and they generally run about $100, so they're not super expensive anyway.
Okay. And I just want to thank you. You are wonderful with analogies. I learned so much from you with your analogies. We all learn differently, but I'm telling you, you're fantastic with that. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It's honest to God, it's how my brain works. And so it's my grasp of meaning is all based on the interactions between things. And I usually will look for something concrete and visual to help convey that information to others. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate all your help.
Thank you, love. Bye-bye. We're going to go now to Nancy. Hello, Nancy.
Hi, I like your demeanor and your calm presence and your education. But I want to ask you again, when we talk about electromagnetic frequency and radiation, and you were saying something about children shouldn't, could you tell me one more time what you said?
Sure. So let me start by explaining that what we know about EMF is that it is a form of radiation, and as it goes, I want you to visualize back to what the previous lady said, Rosemary, I think she was.
Marilyn.
Not Marilyn, the most recent caller. Anyway, that's a digression. But anyway, if you can imagine a soap bubble, there's a guy locally who does shows where he'll stick a needle through a soap bubble or a straw through a soap bubble, but the soap bubble seals. And cell walls are like that. They're like fats. They're like a fat soap bubble. So you can push something through it and it doesn't pop, but it disturbs the surface for a little bit, creates some ripples, and then it closes back over itself. Similar basically to when you throw a stone in water, there, if you're looking at an ultra fast camera, you create a hole in the pond and then the hole closes up. Well, if you imagine that these electromagnetic frequency waves are moving through cell walls and creating little holes which are temporary and then seal themselves up, then when we get down to the mitochondria, which are even smaller than cells and they are inside our cells, you might have, you know, 10,000 mitochondria in a muscle cell, for example. Each of those mitochondria works by building up a pressure of electrons on one side of a membrane, and that pressure then drives, it's like a hydraulic pressure, it drives energy production. So you need that gradient, and the maintenance of that gradient is super, super important. When you run an EMF field through a mitochondria, you lose the gradient, and while the holes exist, the electrons leak through the holes, and so you waste some of the energy, and then they seal back up again, and that's all good. But children have much thinner cell walls, and even their mitochondria have thinner cell walls, so when you run that EMF through their mitochondria, they lose more electrons, and they have more of a hit to that cell. And we're talking about cells that are in the process of dividing and developing. When we talk about children's brains, they're much more metabolically active. And so we're effectively impinging upon critical neurological development and possibly transforming, you know, with some of the behavioral things that we're doing, we're transforming how the brain is wiring itself. And we're also impairing the efficiency of that wiring. And we can know this, and we can look at, say, well, the skull is thinner, and when they're really young, they have cartilage in those fontanelles, so there's no barrier. So whatever EMF hits that cartilage is going straight in with no attenuation. And you start thinking about the implications of this, and again, it's like, well, maybe that's not a good idea. Maybe we shouldn't subject them to it until we know it's safe. Or that, you know, this is a non-issue, that there's plenty of adaptability and that it's just blowing through us the way that the manufacturers wanted us to believe. But it shouldn't be innocent until proven guilty, okay? This sort of thing
right.
should be guilty until proven innocent. Yeah.
Okay, what I wanted to say, that was just the tip of the iceberg of, you know, probably the more damages that it can do in other ways, and like glioblastoma, brain tumors, and all this stuff. And Mel is very educated. She's been studying this for 30 years.
Oh, yeah.
She's no slouch.
Oh, no, I know. I was just going to say on the subject of the glioblastoma, good data from Europe showing that people get glioblastomas on the side they hold the phone.
Yes, and what I'm saying is, it's innocent, and I'm glad you said it, innocent until proven guilty. They're supposed to be on the side of safety for the public, which all throughout history they haven't been, even like with asbestos. And what I'm saying is that it, to me, it's the crime of all crimes. And I love your demeanor and everything, but just because somebody gets emotional doesn't mean they're not intelligent about a subject.
Oh,
it doesn't mean they're it doesn't mean they're an extremist. And what I'm saying is, it's because some of us who really care, I have written about it as a non-scientist and had it published, but in the connection in 2012. But my whole point is, I mean, even I ran into a Chinese person that worked at a shoe store downtown, and he said, I didn't get to vote on this. I don't want to be subjected to this or exposed to this. But there's so many ways they're taking away our freedoms and our health that it's obvious. And, you know,
I'm going to make a comment. I'm going to stop you for just a second. Because this is, I want to give you a little strategic hint, and this is meant with great respect, because I would like to see change, and but I also understand something that you may not understand, which is, if the moment that you get passionate when you're talking to someone who's scientific, who's got a medical degree, or who's, you know, who's in a science world, the minute that you start speaking from passion, you actually make your argument less effective. What really persuades people is data. And passion is what allows us to go out there and search for that data and assemble an overwhelming supply of it so that we can get in, just like debate in high school. I don't know if you ever did that, but they have all these cards, and it's every single possible argument. You've thought of it, and you've got an answer. And so it's like, no. In 2017, so-and-so established blah, blah, blah. And that's how you win this argument. And we've got a huge uphill battle to change, to turn this into something, to create, let's say, even Wi-Fi free zones. That is not even a thing. It should be a thing. But it's not a thing, and we won't make it be a thing. What we've got to do is get the science on our side, which I think is happening, and then take that plus the passion and start really pushing the legislators. We're going to need to leave it there, but I think
could say one more thing?
I don't know. We're down to the list.
It's collateral damage that's already occurred, and then they say, "Oh, I'm sorry, we didn't know. Now we know."
That's a good place to stop, and we're going to take just the last minute for me to remind you that you can reach me by email at askdrdon.com. I'll be back the first Saturday of the month at 3 p.m. And I'm really hoping to see you here and hear from you then. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDon.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDon. For now, this is Dr. Don saying so long, and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Don is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.